This meeting is being recorded.
Welcome to the CEN show, the voice of the world community. The Community Education Network is a team of educators that has a concern about the world community and the direction that it's headed in. Therefore, we take on the philosophy of each one teach one to aid the effort of self and collective improvement. I am your host, Roski Mascani. Tonight's guest is Benita Meeks, and the topic is mortgage underwriting. On January 12th, Benita Meeks' daughter, Brianna, was our guest, and she was on the show also, and she participated and did a great job. It was good having both of them on at the same time. Wish she could have been here tonight. Good evening, Ms. Meeks. How are you? Can you share some things about yourself? And please start your presentation.
Oh, good. I have a big, good evening. How's everyone? I am Benita Meeks. I'm a mortgage underwriter. I have been in the mortgage underwriting business, since 1980, I'd say 88. Since 1988, I've worked for various banks. I've basically have done I'm not familiar with commercial. I'm just do conforming, and conforming is the underwriting process through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which we'll get into a little later. That's conforming versus it's non-FHA, non-VA. When it's non-FHA, non-VA, then it's conforming loan, where you go through your regular lenders. I'm currently employed with Union Bank as an underwriter. And as I said, I've been in the field for, since 1988. I guess I'll get right into the duties of underwriting and what underwriting does. First of all, the community needs to know how important it is, because a lot of underwriting's on the back end. A lot of people don't really know what an underwriter does or the importance of it. But the underwriter is the person that when you go to a loan officer, to the bank, or you have your personal loan officer, and they complete your mortgage loan, because I do mortgage, I'm a mortgage loan underwriter. When you complete your information with them and you give them your documentation and information that's needed, it is submitted to the institution, whether it be a loan servicing company or a bank. It is submitted to them. It goes through a processor. The processor takes the documentation and puts it together. And at that point, provides it to the underwriter when it's completed and sufficient. The underwriter reviews the documentation and makes an initial decision, a conditional decision initially, meaning it's condition. There are conditions that will be required. But as an underwriter, you do an analysis. Our job is to analyze personal and financial information and evaluate whether or not someone satisfies a mortgage lender's criteria and matches the requirements of the type of loan they're applying for. We do the analysis. We analyze. When you submit your W-2s and tax returns and pay stubs, that type of information to your lender, it goes to the underwriter to make a decision. We make a decision. We're like the yay or the nay. And we're the ones that will decline it or approve it. I'm trying to put this in perspective. We'll decline it or approve it. Basically, it's approval. And whether people believe it or not, lenders would rather approve loans than deny. They really would. I've never been anywhere where they just want to deny loans. And you hear people think, oh, they just want to deny loans. No, nowadays, when they deny a loan, they just really have to, because there are guidelines and there are services that the lender has to abide by. And with that being said, it's the loan goes through a system, which is an AUS, which is an automatic underwriting system. That's before it gets to the underwriter. And the automatic underwriting system is either DU, which is desktop underwriting, or LP, which is loan prospector. Loan prospector is basically is a Freddie Mac loan. DU desktop is it's Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. With that, the underwriter receives a readout from the AUS, the automatic system. Now, the automatic system does not give the total yay or nay, but it can help with the decision. It basically kind of makes a decision. When the underwriting system comes back to the underwriter and it's approved and it's good and it says approved, it's usually approved, eligible, then you can go from there. That gives you the startup to complete and go on with your analysis and you're good. Unless that decision on that AUS changes, which it can. And the decision can change from something like your income not being sufficient, which makes your DTI too high. DTI is your debt to income ratio. Your DTI is based off of the total of your debts versus your income. Lenders require, and well, the AUS system requires your DTI to be 45% or less. Now, a lot of lenders, you'll see when you're completing the applications, they'll say 43, which is what they say in standard, but desktop underwriting will do up to 45% DTI, meaning the total of your debts, the new loan payment, your mortgage payment, taxes and insurance, plus any other debt you have, credit cards, anything that shows on the credit report, credit cards, car payments, child support payments, things such as that. Those figures total divided by your income gives a DTI ratio. If your DTI ratio is too high, then DU will read it. It won't accept it. It'll flag us. You know, it'll give us a warning, like their warning, such as refer with caution or approve ineligible. Things such as that. And that's what it will read, which gives us a flag. Doesn't mean we can't do it, but as an underwriter, then we have to get into it, dive into it to see what went wrong and whether it can be approved. So the AUS system helps the underwriter with making the decision. And in some cases, it's almost like it does make the decision. In a way, it makes the decision as long as the documentation is implemented correctly in the system for it to read. Now, your AUS can always will change with your appraised value because your AUS is reads your income, your credit report, the appraisal and the value, your debt ratio, as I just stated. It reads all of that and it determines, and even the product. Sometimes a product isn't what you might apply. I had a loan today, for instance. They wanted a refinance cash out and they wanted to subordinate a second and a third Cal half a loan, which that second and third gives them another ratio, another LTV. LTV is your loan to value. Am I not confusing you guys, am I? Because I know I'm speaking in my terms, but I have to.
Well, when you're defining these acronyms, that helps.
Okay.
It
Yes,
helps.
they really have to be defined. Yes. So an LTV is a loan to value. And your loan to value is your loan amount divided by your appraised value or sales price, whichever is less. If your appraised value is less than your sales price, then it will be of your appraised value. If the sales price is less, it will be divided by the sales price. And that's only on a purchase. When you're doing a refinance, it's strictly based off the appraisal. So it is the loan amount. For instance, if you have a loan amount of, you have a sales price of $100,000. I'm gonna make it easy with mathematics for myself. You have a sales price of $100,000, and you have a loan amount of $50,000. That is a 50% LTV. 50,000 is 50% of 100,000. Okay. So the LTV is important also because it has to fit within the mortgage standard RAM. It has to fit within the guidelines per Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which is the AUS system. The AUS systems are Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And if the LTV, meaning the value versus the loan amount versus the value, if that is over an amount that the AUS system will accept or within the parameters, it'll flag it also. That's also another flag. It will not accept it. So that's another thing that is important. There's also three C's to underwriting: credit, collateral, and capacity. With credit, there's your FICO, there's your credit history, how you pay your credit, balances on your credit. That's something that people don't realize also is they'll say, why is my FICO score not higher than I pay everything on time? I'm never late. Well, the system, FICO, which is credit, all that's conglomerated. The FICO credit system reads more than just how you pay your credit. It reads how you use your credit. It reads how many credit lines you have, how much you use your credit. For instance, if you have a credit line of $5,000 and you have a $3,500 balance on that, but you pay as agreed and you're never late, that affects your FICO because you have a high usage of the line. Versus if you have that same $5,000 credit line, credit card credit line, and you have a $500 balance, that brings the FICO down. So, how you use your credit, how you keep balances versus credit limits, credit lines, credit limits, that affects the credit. The better your FICO score, the better interest rate you will get with anybody, even on a consumer loan, such as automobiles. The better your FICO score, the better the interest rate. When you see all these things on television and they say, oh, you can get this with nothing down or this or that, it's all based on a FICO score. So the better the FICO score, the better the interest rate. And that's the better pricing, as they say. So that's something that's real important that a lot of people don't realize. They think, because they pay on time, that their credit is enough, that they should have a better reading. Well, your reading is based on several things on that FICO score. And also, it is also based upon how you pay. If you have delinquent credit, you can still get a loan. It all depends on how old it is. how much delinquent credit you have. You can have a bankruptcy and get a loan, get a mortgage loan, but it has to be discharged. It has to have been discharged for 7 years, I think it is. I may have that wrong, but I think it's 5 to 7 years. It has to be discharged. So you can have it on your credit because it's not going to leave your credit within that shorter period of time, but it's going to reflect discharged. And as long as you've paid your other credit as agreed, you're able to get a loan. Tax liens, you can get a mortgage loan as long as it's paid tax lien. Unless, if it's a tax lien that's on your title, because tax liens follow you. Some people don't know that either. A tax lien follows you. If you have an issue with with taxes and tax liens, it's on your credit, or if it's not on your credit, it's probably on your title. And that can cause a lot of issues also. So another thing is capacity. Capacity is your income, employment, liabilities. Your income on your application, which is they call it URLA now, URLA. It's a 1003, but they call it an URLA. They've changed the term. Your employment status, your representative will ask you for a 2-year history. They need at least a 2-year work history. It doesn't have to be with the same employer, but it should be in the same line of work, unless you've left a place of employment to better yourself. For instance, if you were working at Starbucks, as you know, you're young, maybe you're coming out of school or just in between jobs or whatever, and you're working at Starbucks, and you now have, and you work there for 6 months, and now for a year and a half, you've worked at Apple, you know, you're a tech rep with Apple. Well, that's a 2-year history. It's not in the same line of work, but it does show that you have a 2-year history of employment, and that current employment is considered because it's a betterment in a sense. You've improved your sense of employment and income. Tax returns for income. They will, in most cases, require 1-year tax returns, depending on the AUS system. Some places will automatically ask you for 2-year tax returns. They just want them because, you know, I guess they want to be a step ahead of if the underwriter or if the system requires it. It used to be standard for 2 years tax returns on all loans. They don't really do that anymore. But they do require 1 year if the system requires 1 year. And the system has currently adjusted to just 1 year tax returns, unless you're self-employed. They want, and even in some self-employed cases, but the DU, there I go again with the DU, the desktop is the one who dictates that. It will say, we only need 1 year tax returns for this borrower, the most recent. Or it will say we need 2-year tax returns, you know, in the verbiage. Regular salaried income, salaried borrower. The requirement is current W-2 and a current 1-month pay stub, a pay stub to cover 1 month's earnings. You need at least that for the underwriter to get started to determine and verify your income. Current 1 month's pay stub and W-2 from the prior year. That's on salaried income earners. Like I said, on self-employed borrowers, if you're a big business owner with 1120s, you know, business tax returns, K-1s, partnerships, Those are a lot of fun. excuse me. Those will require 2 years. 2 years K-1s, 2 years tax returns, 2 years 1120s, 2 year 1040s. They will require 2 years. The DU is not going to require 1 year on those. The DU, with their status as a business owner with a sole proprietor and partnerships, is going to require the 2 years. That's your capacity, which is income, employment, and liabilities. Your liabilities, you list on the IRLA, which is the application. You list them when you complete it, but the credit report is going to pull up what's submitted from the creditors. Usually it matches, and it should, but sometimes there are items that come up on credit that weren't listed on the application. In that case, we just add it. It has to be included. It's on the credit report. So your liabilities, your financial responsibility, alimony, child support, we do add in. We do consider that. Child support and alimony has to be considered. And alimony is verified through and child support through divorce decrees or judgments and current receipt of or current payment of. For instance, if you're receiving child support, we have to verify it from current receipt that you receive it from, the whoever the entity is. Sometimes it's straight from the spouse, sometimes it's through the court systems. We have to verify current receipt of and current receipt of alimony. And alimony is verified with tax returns if you've received it for 2 years or at least 12 months if it shows on the tax returns. Because child support is not taxable unless you're paying it. I don't even think then. But child support, we don't verify it with the tax returns. Child support is verified with supporting documentation. There was something else I wanted to go over about liabilities. That's a little important. It has to do with, oh, another thing. Liabilities, if other income is considered, for instance, child support. That's a good one. If you receive child support for a minor, we can use it as income. It is used as income. But we must have a 3 year continuance of that income. And the way we verify that is we're going to ask for the dissolution, the divorce decree, the judgment, which will show what goes to the child, the age of the child at the time, and we calculate and determine how old the child is. If there is no 3 year continuance, it can't be used. If you're, for instance, child support usually stops, what, 18? Well, if your child is 15, you can use that income. If you get $800 a month child support, we can add that in. But if your child is 16, we won't use it. So that's something that a lot of people don't know. I've had a friend who was receiving a SSI for her deceased spouse. And her daughter was a teenager, young, 14, and she was looking to buy a house. And I told her, do it before she's 15 years old, or by the time she's 15, excuse me, because after that, you won't be able to use that income. And she was receiving, I think, $1,000 a month. And that makes a big difference when you're qualifying for something, that extra money or extra income. But if you don't do it at their age where it can be considered, it can't be used. So your liabilities, all your debt, your credit. In mortgage underwriting, we don't consider life insurance, daycare. Don't put that down. We don't consider it. We don't add it. We don't analyze it. FHA does, to my knowledge. Mortgage lending, we don't consider those liabilities at all. Okay, I went over that.
So at this point, Ms. Meeks, I'm gonna go ahead and see if anyone has questions or comments at this point. Okay, I'm gonna start with Professor Rob. Professor Rob?
All right. Again, appreciate what you presented, Ms. Meeks, and it's beautiful for you to detail the workings of underwriting. First of all, I want to apologize for eating on air. I didn't know. I thought I had blocked my camera. I wasn't looking up. I had a diabetic thing.
Oh, well, no, you got to take care of what you got to,
You
got to be on time, right?
Sugar, my sugar dropped on me, and I didn't even look up. And then I looked up, and Rasha Keith took care of the business. But I apologize to you and all the people watching. I just have a couple questions. There's been a history of race being a factor in financing and underwriting. I know maybe there be some progress, but there has been some news reports of banks that, for whatever reason, have not provided the loans for African Americans as with the same efforts that they do with other racial groups, even Latino. Is there any reality to that?
I saw on the news the other day, Wells Fargo, correct? I think they said Wells Fargo.
Yeah, Wells Fargo, Bank of America.
Yeah. I personally, I've been in the industry a long time. I have not seen racial redlining, but I know it does exist. I do know that on your application, and everything is so automated now, you can get your loan done and not even see your loan representative in today's world. And you do not have to fill out the bottom of the government census where they ask you what your race is, you know, your race, your gender, that type of thing. You don't have to complete that section, but the government monitoring section, but the lender, that representative has to put something in there. So if they're talking to you, if they never see you and you don't want, and you don't fill that portion out, they have to put something in there. They have to state whether they think you're white or you're Black, or you're Latino. They may go, sometimes they could go by a name or an accent or whatever. I don't like that, but that's the way it's done.
Okay.
That section, you do not have to fill out, but it has to be, you have to, they have to know whether you're Black or other or whatever, that type of thing.
Can I jump in on that for a second?
Go ahead.
Just really quick. Now, what if somebody lie and say that, say for instance, they're Black and they say, oh, I'm Hispanic or Asian. Have you run into anything like that before, where somebody lied about their race?
No, I don't question it.
Okay.
Because nowadays we're not sitting at a desk in front of you. Now the loan person who takes the application, if that person walks into an office and fills it out, they can have doubts. Now, whether they change it or not, they're not at liberty of changing it once you put on there what you put, because, I mean, there could be people who look like us who have a white mother and want to be white, you know, want to be specified as white or Latin, or so they can't change that once you put whatever you put in there. But if it's not completed, they completed based upon visual. If you come in, you speak with them, they've seen you, and you don't fill that out, then they'll put black or white or Latin or whatever. They will complete that part. Mm-hmm. I do know in underwriting, we don't, as far as a loan being made, we just look to see if that part of the documentation is completed. That's all. With the redlining, the way that they say it is, and I know it exists, I haven't directly seen it. I've also had people question, for years they've questioned, the area. Well, they didn't give me a loan because I lived in this area, because they didn't want, black people in the area or whatever. I don't think that's usually a lender issue. I think that's more of like real estate. That's usually stops and start with real estate. When you go to purchase the place and you go and look at it, and nowadays sellers have so much say so over who buys their homes, that's where it basically is too. You have a seller that's Latin and they only want a Latin family to buy their home. They can do that because they have the say so over who they tell the listing agent or the buying agent are the people that come in who they want to buy their home. Years ago, you never saw your seller, when you were purchasing a home. You went, looked at the place, and there were different formalities. And now the seller wants to see your income and they want to see your reserves. And I think it's a bit much, but that's just how things have turned.
Now, I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
When it comes down to down payments and, the housing market has skyrocketed for a little while. I don't know if it still is or if it's stabilized. Because that's one of the biggest challenges African Americans have. That's one. The other one is, first answer that. Let's say, for instance, you're in a market where houses have been appraised at $800,000. Mm-hmm. Do you have to come up with that down payment of close to 10-20%, for the lending institution, or who determined the down payment, the minimum down payment? The lending institution, or is there some other criteria that determines how much you can put down on a house?
The program determines, again, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The program determines how much is required for a down payment. If you are purchasing a home, owner-occupied, you can put 10% down. You can put 5% down. They're doing 95% financing now.
So if a house is $1 million, you got to come up with $100,000.
Well, on those high, see, that's a jumbo loan. Those are jumbos. That's another category. So big dollars, right? That's bigger dollars.
In Downey and houses in Torrance, they're going for, close to $900,000.
Yep.
Carson. Bedroom. So they're considered jumbo. What is the criteria for a jumbo loan?
Jumbo loan is usually full doc, meaning there's a lot more documentation. It's not streamlined.
You said it's a jumbo loan.
They want more than 10% down on most cases. And also, I can't think of the term, but there's a term where it has to do with areas, and the pricing of the homes determines on whether or not it could fit in with the 20% down or less. Now, the down payment you put on a home or to buy a place depends on whether you want 80% financing, or you want 90% financing, or you want 95% financing. It depends on you, what you want to do, or 25% or 75%. Now, if you're buying an investment property, you have to put 25% down. There's no way around that. But if you're buying owner-occupied, even if it's a duplex, up 1 to 4 units. If you're buying a 4-unit property and you're going to live in one, that's considered an owner-occupied unit because you're going to live in one of them. You can put 10% or 20% down. But if you purchase a 4-unit property or a 2-unit property and you're not living in it and it's an investment, you have to put 25% down. That is standard. That is standard. Now, getting back to what you were saying, there are programs out there, and this is where our people are lost. I just have to be honest. You know, first of all, pushing my daughter's book again. Brianna's book goes through all of that. There are programs. There is money out there to help people with their down. Union Bank has grants. The grants are determined by the geographical area and the medium income. As long as you make within 80% of the medium income of the general area, and that area is within where the system accepts it, which is usually, then you will receive, in LA County, you'll get $9,000. In Riverside and San Diego County's $9,000, but Riverside and outside counties, Oxnard, out that way, Kern County, you get $6,000. And that's
10%. I mean, when the house is $800,000, $9,000.
Well, that has just recently happened with this escalation over the past 2 years. Okay. The problem with that is people don't go where they fit in. They go where they want to be. Oh, I want to live in Downey. Oh, I want to live here. Okay, can you afford it? And especially now, it's tough.
Okay. The other question is, you know, you see a lot of people, group of people want to buy the property and live in it. Let's say, for instance, a 4-bedroom and 4 different families or 4 different people. Mm-hmm. Is that a possibility for income or live in?
Latinos do that all the time. That's why we see them everywhere with property. They are very savvy, very, very savvy. They can live together, they will live together, and they will combine money and join families. Some Asian communities too, but it's very common with Latinos. You'll find 3 brothers that will buy a house and live in it, or either 2 of the brothers will live in it and 1 brother has his family, but it helps when the more people you have, the better it is with qualifications. But they are very, very savvy with that. They will join together, like you were saying. And it doesn't matter how many people join together that want to be on the house. Well, it's up to 4 now, I think. It's a max 4 people. Because back in the day, we used to get totally overwhelmed with, you know, you got 6-7 people. And when we evaluate that, we have to evaluate each person. We have to run credit on each. We have to do income analysis, liability analysis on each person individually, and then conglomerate it, then just bring it together. But that is something that Latinos are extremely savvy with. They will buy property together, like what you're saying. So mm-hmm. It's no more than, I think it's 4 people, but mm-hmm. it's not a problem as long as they each have income. And they each don't have to have income, as long as it could be 2 couples and the husband's work, and we just use the husband's income, and okay. Could take it from there.
The last question so others can ask, and I'll add some more later. But what about the proof of down payment, where you got the money from? That runs into a lot of issues.
Good question.
People, some they say some people don't even have to prove where they got it. Like Latinos say they don't use banks or something like that. They just save their money. But when it comes to African Americans, you have to prove where you got your down payment. And it can't be a loan. It has to be either a gift or some type of savings or something like that. Is that correct? And how do we deal with that?
It's not totally correct. We don't, as far as, that's called mattress money is what you're speaking of. And that used to be a no-no in the industry. A no-no. I think now they have some leeway with it, but there's a max amount. You can't have a whole lot of money. There's a max amount. But all your down cannot be mattress money. Now, your money for down payment, it's not a discriminatory issue. It's a money issue and a bank issue and having money in the bank. And what I tell people when they're looking for a home, you know, if you're searching and you're looking and you know you want to buy, whatever money you're going to use as the down payment, don't touch it. Leave it alone. Because as an underwriter, we get real tricky with that. We get real picky, you know, and people get upset. Well, why do they want to know where I got this money from? We have to, because Fannie Mae, Fannie Freddie, you know, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. Banks are underwriting under Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's guidelines. They're actually the ones that are making a lot of the guidelines with telling banks what they can and can't do to a degree. Now, I'm trying to get back to your question. Oh, down payment. The down payment has to be seasoned for 2 months. All the lender's going to ask for is 2 months bank statement. So if somebody gives you $10,000, put it in the bank and you know you're going to use it towards a down payment. Put it in the bank and let it sit there for 2 months. And show, and it, that balance will show consecutively for 2 months. But if you have 2 months bank statements and 1 month shows $5,000 and the next month shows $15,000 balance with a $10,000 deposit, the underwriter is going to question, where'd that $10,000, what's the source, and explain it. And you have to give proof of the source. If someone gave you a gift, then you've got to show that that they wrote you a check and it was a gift or whatever. If the money came from, if you transferred it from another account, you've got to show. And sometimes on these new statements now, it will show a transfer. For instance, if you only use your Chase account for your down payment evidence, or you're applying for the loan and you use just your Chase account, and your Chase account shows that you have a large deposit from Navy Federal Credit Union of $10,000. The underwriter is going to question, where's that money come from, and give us evidence of it. So what you will have to do, because it shows on there is from Navy Federal Credit Union, you're going to have to provide that statement to show that you had that money and it came from that account. It sounds picky, but that's just the way the industry is. And it's always been that way, long as I've been in the industry. And there's nothing discriminatory with that. You just have to do it. Yeah, it's not a black or brown thing. Or now Latinos do have mattress money. You don't see that. I haven't seen it in years. Because mattress money at one point was just a no-no. We just could not use it. They couldn't use mattress money. And that's what it's called. We have to be able to verify the source of the funds. And if you're using money towards a down payment, I always recommend, for instance, if you have a savings account and that's where the money is. Now you can deposit, they're going to question any type of deposit transaction. If you take money out, we don't question you taking money out. We question you putting money into that account. So if you have a savings account, and this is where the money's coming from that I'm going to use to put down on my place that I'm looking for, and it may take me 3 months, you know, the way the market is, then whenever you deposit money in that account, that is, let me correct this. If your large deposit exceeds 50% of your salary, if you make $5,000 a month and your deposit into your bank account is $2,500, then we question it. If your deposit is $2,000, we don't, because that's less than 50% of your earnings. So just remember that if you make $10,000 a month and you have a $2,500 deposit, we're not going to question the $2,500 deposit. But if you have a $10,000 salary and you have a $5,000 deposit, that's 50% of your earnings, so we question it. Or a $7,500 deposit, we question it. You have to source it.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Brother Doctor?
Yeah. Well, I had to answer a few questions on that. Let's go on to finance real quick, because I want to ask you about the jumbo conventional FAA, because I think it's a max limit. But let's go to the banking question. Let me ask you this. I want to see how you guys think. Mm-hmm. I'm applying for a loan, and I'm showing you what I have in my savings. And just say I have $100,000 in my savings, and you start with a $100,000 house. So if I have $100,000 in my savings, I'm buying a $100,000 house. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Now this is my other question. Why now? Do I have to show you that I got another account with $100,000? How would that help me if I show you that I got another savings account with $100,000? Because I would like to keep that private without showing
you. You don't have to disclose all your money, and I tell people that.
Right.
Disclose what you need to get the loan.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that.
Yes.
Because would that hurt me?
The loan. Right. If that $100,000 is what you're going to need to get the loan. Now, if something comes up and you run short to close, means short funds to close, and you have another account, then you can always, it happens all the time. You know, say it happened the other day. Oh, well, they're short $44,000 to close. You know, we need another $40,000. And they went to their retirement account. And they sent to a retirement account for 2 months, covered 2 months. They had the money in there and they were fine. Another thing about retirement.
That's great. So I don't have to show all my cards. So it's cool. Don't tell, you know, because I know, you know, I've seen people where
you show them the money card, that you need, right? That you need
just the minimum or the average. Okay. Another question. And look, a bunch of these are going to be like facts, fiction. If I put down 50%, mm-hmm. do I need to show income?
Yes.
Okay. Next question.
Only time you're not going to show income is if you do one of those. They have these new loans, ATRs, they call them, where they go by your business statements, and they're very detailed. They're not in the conforming realm, but they have something like that. But that's the only time you're going to show income always.
Regardless, right? Okay.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you. Okay. So I know it's like when you were putting down facts, fiction. Put down 20%, you're going to automatically qualify. Is that true or false?
No. You don't automatically qualify for anything.
Okay.
No, there is no. Back in the day, they had a stated income. That's what got us into this mortgage meltdown back in the early 2008. 2000s.
2007, yeah. That's going to be another question.
And I remember when stated income, stated assets, they called them, it was no income, no asset. They called it a NINA, N-I-N-A. I'll never forget when it first came into existence. And, you know, we're underwriters. It's like, you mean we don't have to verify this stuff? Or we don't, you know, blah, 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 blah. And the FICO thing was so big. And if you had a FICO of a certain number and above, and you had stable income, stable employment, like you couldn't say that I'm an educator and I make $30,000 a month. I mean, we kind of know, but as long as that income, and some may, you know, higher up, but I mean like a regular teacher or whatever, or even an underwriter, you're not going to say, they know underwriters don't make $30,000 a month. But as long as your income was stated within a reasonable amount for what you, your profession, we just based it on that. But they don't, they cut that out because that's what got us in this mess that we were in, that we just got over.
Okay. The other question was, Rock kind of brought it up, and that was one on the FHA conventional jumbo. My understanding is, if you want to do FHA or something like that, you had to go conventional jumbo because they had a ceiling, a max you can borrow. Is that true? Or because FHA, would they loan you? Can you get $1 million loan?
Or that I don't know. I'm not an FHA underwriter, but I think FHA has a lot of stipulations.
Okay. Because they have a max they will loan
FHA,
you.
Okay. Right. FHA allows a higher DTI, your income divided by your debts divided by your income. FHA requires like 47%. I mean, they allow you to go higher, but they have a lot of stipulations.
Because I haven't been in the business in years. I just know they had a limit where they can loan. You couldn't, and like Professor Robert said, they wouldn't give you a loan on $1 million. You have to go
conventional. They may have increased it a bit, but FHA has a lot of even on appraising the homes, on the value, appraising your properties. FHA is a real stickler, and you'll notice with going to look for homes, some homes will say that they're not FHA approved. They don't want FHA lenders.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And another question: you just talked about the 2008 issue. I remember that, and I'm a big fan of the movie The Big Short. Do you think that ever would happen again? How they those loans, you know.
I think that, see, they track the loan officers now. You are tracked. And if you're doing bad loans, and we're not doing just loans based on FICO. I mean, we were doing mortgage loans based on a FICO score. That's what the no income, no assets.
Correct.
You know, we didn't have to verify assets. We didn't have to verify income. If you had a FICO of back then 750, because back then you didn't see 800 scores. You rarely saw 800 scores. So if you had a 750 FICO score and, you know, everything else fit, you'd get that loan, you know. But they're not doing that anymore. The criteria has really, you know, with underwriting, we do a lot of more research and with our analysis than we used to. There's even a system called Data Verify. Data Verify is a system that's run on every loan. And what Data Verify does is it verifies all your data. It verifies all the mortgages you've ever had in your name. For instance, if you are on a loan with your brother on the title, and you go to apply for a loan with Union Bank and you're going to buy a house, and you don't list that, you just, you know, it's your brother, you know, you and your brother have it, but you don't list it, you know. Data Verify is going to find it, and it's going to flag the underwriter that you have another mortgage in your name. And then what the underwriter has to do is verify, you know, they go, you know, they send notification to the borrower. 1414 Mockingbird Lane shows that you know you're vested on this property, you know, yada yada yada. So if the borrower comes back and says, well, my brother and I own that place. Well, if you can show that your brother makes the mortgage payment, we can eliminate that debt with a 12-month history. And that is on any installment. I'm glad I've gotten into that. Any installment debt, car loan, any type of installment loan, not revolving, auto loan, if it's in your name, it shows on your credit, and you say, well, I don't make that payment. My brother pays it, or my sister, or my daughter. You would have to show 12 months history of them making the payment on that loan, and we will not consider it. I have a loan I'm working on now. I'll be finishing up tomorrow. He has two auto loans, $750 payments each. They're for his brother. So he provided 12 months canceled checks or 12 month bank statements from his brother showing that transaction of the payment. And he's not liable. We won't hit him with the payment.
A few more, but like Ross Key, you can go around a couple more. You know, we'll come back, see if anybody else got questions.
Okay. Brother Hambrick?
Yeah, I had a couple of questions. Number one, on the FICO score.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to question you then at the time you were on it and see if I understood correctly. And in order to get a high FICO score, is it better to owe a lot and just make the payments or just have a little loan there and you pay it off constantly? Which one increases your FICO score?
I see you're asking whether it's the amount of credit you have versus how much credit you have.
It's how much credit you use. Is it good mm-hmm. to use a lot of credit card stuff and make monthly payments? Or is it best to just like if you use a credit card and it's $200-$300 and you constantly pay it off every month, which one increases your FICO score the most?
Using it and paying it off.
Okay.
Because the use of it is important. Because if you have a line on there that you don't use, it helps, but you're not using it. And that's fine. But it's better than having something on there with a high balance. The high balances are what hurt. The use of the credit isn't what hurts, but the high balance. And don't be late. I missed a payment on a credit card the other month, just overlooking it because I hadn't used it. It was paid off. Forgot to make the payment because I totally forgot it. It went into a 30-day status. I said, oh, my FICO dropped 15 points for a 30-day late.
Yeah, I know it takes about a year to get late off your credit.
Well, the thing about late is I just paid it off. But the thing about that is the lenders look at late. We don't look at, we look at a 24-month paid as agreed history. And the system will flag if you've paid, if you've been late and you have paid it as agreed for 24 months, it doesn't even affect DU. The automatic system isn't affected by it, you know, as far as affecting your score with the system. So you can have a late here or there. People have lates, but it's about, you know, getting rid of it, paying it off. The lates you have to work on right away. And that I was so upset with that. But, you know, it was just an oversight, something that I did. But my score has gone back up because of other parts of my credit that I use.
Okay.
So that brought it down. But then, you know, it hasn't gone up to 15 points. And then another thing. There are three bureaus used. Equifax, Experience, and TransUnion. There are three bureaus used on all mortgage loans. Never one. Sometimes only two will read out, but there's always the three bureaus that we rate. So, like the situation that I've spoken for myself personally with that oversight, that's one bureau. That's not all three of them. It reports to, because all creditors don't report to all three. You may have a car that reports to TransUnion. You may have a JCPenney's that reports to Equifax. You may have your Chase account that reports to Experian. That's usually how it is. They report to various entities in a lot of cases. So that makes a difference too. Like when you get a notification from your credit card, because they'll let you know about your FICO. Well, they only use one bureau. They're not using three bureaus. They're letting you know what that, when they let me know about that account and my FICO was hit, good thing I had a high FICO because I could afford to lose 15 points. But when they notified me of that, that's one bureau. That's not all three of them. But when you get a mortgage loan, all three bureaus are considered. And with your FICO score, while we're speaking of that, and it's on my mind, the middle score is what's used. Experian, you may have a 750 FICO. Equifax, you may have a 780 FICO. TransUnion, you may have an 800. Well, that 800 score is not going to be considered. The 780 score is, because it's the middle score. So the middle score is what's always considered in mortgage underwriting. Always has, and it still is. The middle score. So there are people that have had, they might have a 750 score with one entity and a 680 with another, and a 640 with another. Well, the 680 is used, and they're thinking, well, I have a 720 FICO score, you know, but that's with that bureau. That's not with, you know, it's the conglomeracy of the three. So with one bureau, you may have a low score, a lower score, and with one, you may have a high score. But the system in underwriting, they're going to look at the middle score. The middle score is what's always used in determining factor. And that's what the AUS automatic underwriting systems use, is the middle score.
Second question, I think it's kind of been addressed somewhat, but on the Sally Mae and Freddie Mac loans, I remember years ago, you know, the property value could only be a certain amount, you know, that they would cover. I think back before the big explosion, it was like $400,000 in today's market. That's a window, so. You know what the limit is on Sally Mae and Freddie Mac?
Fannie Mae, Fannie and Freddie have the same limit. It's higher. It was 400 and something. It's now up to 5. I can't remember exactly.
Okay. All right.
But so, it's the max. Yeah, it's like 5 something. And that also has to do with location.
Right.
If you're speaking in Santa Barbara, that 500, I think it's, I guess because the system does a whole lot for us now, we don't have to really evaluate that, but we do have to know it. If you're looking in Santa Barbara, that medium income, loan amount, it's going to be more than 500 and some thousand, because the average home in that area is probably a lot more. So it all has to do with that too, geographics.
Okay, my last question is about appraisal discrimination. You know, they tend to always lowball us in the minority communities when it comes to appraising properties. I saw in the news today where this person had, on the first appraisal, they had a bunch of black, art and stuff in the house and all of that. and they got appraised at one thing. Then they did a second appraisal and took all the, you know, took all the ethnic stuff out the house and had a lot of white stuff. And then they got appraised a lot higher than you know, than they did the first time. So you know, that's definitely a form of appraisal discrimination, and they always tend to lowball us in the Black community. Can you address that?
The thing about that is, when I heard about it, I don't disbelieve it. I do believe it, but appraisers are certified with the state. And appraisers no longer work in the banks or for the banks because of that. Back in the day, when I first got into underwriting, you had your loan officers, you had your processing department, and you had underwriters, and you had an appraisal department, all up under the same roof. Well, now, everybody, you know, right. The appraisers are no longer employees of the bank. No longer. They're like contracted out in a sense. They work for either themselves or appraisal entities, and they're like contracted in with the banks. The banks pick, you know, they have appraiser list, and that's who they pick, and they'll do their appraisals. And the reason for that was managers and some underwriters, sometimes underwriters would give, if it's a purchase and the appraisal comes in $5,000 low, and the manager would give the appraisal a hard time, not rudely, but can you give me $5,000 more, or we only need $10,000 more on this, you know, you can find it somewhere, da 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 da. They would find it and make it work. So that's why appraisers are not in under the umbrella with the brand, with the banks anymore. Yeah, they're their own entity. They work, they are certified through the state. They are state certified appraisers. And I don't think that was in California. Depending on the states, I'm not saying that didn't happen. But I can't see how that appraiser, with reviewing appraisals, I can't see how he or she could justify lowering and or increasing a value. What did they use to compensate decreasing the value? Because appraisers have to, they have comps, and everything has to be within a range. And if my house is the same size as yours down the street, that's a comp, and your house was sold within 6 months, that's a comp. But you may have put some work into your house. Your house may be a, you know, more updated, yada, yada, yada. That's adjusted. And you don't get a whole lot more money for that, but you do get some more. You know, people think, oh, well, I remodeled my kitchen and I remodeled this and I did that. Your home location and the square footage is determined by basically by that, not only that, but basically. Pools, you get some thousand, you know, you're not going to get $30,000 for a pool adjustment. If you have a pool, you might get $15,000 extra value. That's another thing people think. They think because they have a pool, they're going to get $25,000 more. You don't. You know, the adjustments are not as high as people think. There are adjustments for newer, you know, for upgrades, but it's not a whole, you know, if you have a $25,000 kitchen that you remodel, you're not going to get $25,000 extra in value. You're just not.
I, on my last purchase, which is this house I'm in now, about 15 years ago, the appraisal came in at $10,000 less than the asking price. And so I didn't want to lose it over $10,000, so I just paid the $10,000. But I'm glad I did, because now...
Right, it was worth it.
Oh yeah, the property now is probably...
Yeah, and that happens. So it was $10,000 less than the purchase price.
Right, the loan they would give $10,000 less.
And the sellers wouldn't lower the sales price to meet it, right?
No, they wouldn't. Right. And it was a suitable family, but I went on it because I waited on the house for a couple of years waiting to get it. Mm-hmm. And but I'm glad I did because now I'm north of 1.1 mil right now.
Right. The thing with real estate, like Warren Buffett said, buy it and wait.
Yeah, exactly.
Eventually, you're going to see. It's the biggest investment and turnover that you will get in your life from any other entity. The stock market, you know, the stock market's quick and it's up and down. But real estate, you know, you can buy it and say, oh, did I really want this house? Or, you know, like Brianna bought that little condo, you know, didn't have parking and it was downstairs. It was nice, you know, nice older place, fixed up real nice. It turned out really good for her, you know, but she got in where she fit in, where she could afford, and she had a $15,000 grant. Speaking of that grant money, Unforgivable. Look for Unforgivable silent grants. When it's silent, it means it doesn't have a monthly payment, and you want it forgivable. That way, when it may be 15 years or it may be when you refi, or it just depends on the type of the term of the grant, but you don't have to pay it back. That's the thing with grants. And in 5 years, Brianna had $90,000 in equity. Sit and wait.
Yeah. Only thing real is real estate. That's my mom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. Let me get my charger. Excuse me 1 second. My battery's on.
Brother Mashinda, do you have questions lined up or comments? Brother Mashinda. Okay, Professor Rod, you got more questions?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when we were purchasing our house and you know, they were asking for the bank statements. We couldn't really touch our bank account too much just to pay our bills. That was it. You couldn't do anything extra. You couldn't purchase new things. I remember that vividly. You couldn't, when you're in the process of buying that home.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't touch that bank account.
Right. You should actually pay your bills. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the experience we had where
we had to leave it alone. Mm-hmm. Leave it alone. Yeah. Because what happens is people run into the underwriter questioning things and, you know, they get a little upset with, well, this is my money. You know, I mean, we all think like that. Why are you worried about, you know, yada, yada, yada. But that's just, it's the policy. It's standard in the industry. And if you have the deposits are what they're concerned with. And if it's, like I said, if it's 50% or more of your base salary, the underwriter's going to question it and you have to answer it and verify the source. But if it's less than 50%, then we don't. Can you hear me?
Brother Mashinda?
Oh, okay. I thought I had lost my volume.
Yeah. Okay, so he must be somewhere else at the moment. So, Brother Doctor, did you have any more questions?
You know, let me ask one. Retirement. I'm retired. How does that affect getting along? And I have a retirement income. It'd be considered salary. So it'd be just like a regular salary employer?
Yes. Right. See it all the time. all the time. A lot of retirees buying homes, refinancing. Long as you qualify, that's all that matters now. Social Security income is considered. I've even done refinances on two individuals, a husband and wife, and all their income is just Social Security. Now, on Social Security, your Social Security can be increased 25% if it's not for the non-taxable amount, but you have to provide tax returns to show it's non-taxable. So if you can provide tax returns, your tax returns, you know, and it shows on there your social, you know, the amount you get and then the non-taxable amount. So we see that there's a non-taxable amount. We increase that by 25%. So that's another, it's called grossed up. Yeah, it's grossed up. But Social Security, retirement, see it all the time. They cannot discriminate for that. Retirement, Social Security, child support, alimony. I had a lady who was getting she got a real good alimony. And the thing with alimony is we have to read the decree, you know, the marriage dissolution. We have to see it to see how long she'll get it. Some people get it for a lifetime. Some people get it for, you know, so many years or whatever. But again, long as there's that 3-year continuance. If you have a retirement account, like a Fidelity or an IRA mutual fund, and you receive distributions, monthly distributions, long as there's a 3-year continuance, as long as we can verify that you're receiving distributions and, you know, the amount, some people have a set amount. It needs to be a monthly distribution. That income is considered. That's not a problem. As long as your retirement account shows, for instance, you get $3,000 a month out of your retirement account and you have a Roth IRA or something that has, just say $100,000 maybe. Might go higher. I'll just say $100,000 because I'm only using $3,000. Well, that $3,000 a month for 12 months is $36,000, right? Yeah, $36,000 annually. So that $36,000 annually times 3, well, I'll say more than $100,000. Just say you got $250,000 in there. And you are paying yourself, you're receiving $3,000 a month distributions. So that's $36,000 a year. So we take the $36,000 a year, multiply it by 3, which is what, 9, 3, 7, 8, I'm not good with the math that great. But anyway, whatever that is, as long as it's less than what, as long as you have that in your fund to substantiate and cover that, then you can use that. You can use it. But you
know, I'm glad you brought that up. You may have to come on another show. Let me ask you a quick question, I'm trying to phrase it away where it won't be financial advice. So let me ask you, what would you do? And you talked about the Roth, the 401ks. Uh-huh. You have a Roth with $3 million in it. And, you know, Roth, you can take out tax-free. Mm-hmm. You buy the $1 million house. Do you pay that off? Would you pay that off, the whole million? Or would you just go ahead and get a loan and just keep most of your money in your Roth and just get a basic loan? Or would you just pay that million off, the house off?
I see what you're saying. Well, yeah,
What would you do?
It all depends. I mean, do you want to be debt free? Do you
want to be debt free? Yeah. Okay, is that good? Yeah. Would you do that? Pay it off?
Just to be, I mean, I consider that. I mean, hey, when I get there, I'll let you know. Oh Lord. No, some people they don't finance they finance some of the home because they want the write-off. They want the deduction. But mortgage that's interest right isn't... There.
Yeah, they want the deduction. That comes into question. Yeah. Write-off so that's for the taxes. And one more question. Now I'm going to have to stop. Now, I don't see this, you know, someone had $10 million. They got $10 million in the bank. They bought a $3 million house. Decided to like the house and let it go into foreclosure. The banks can't come after you, even though you still got money to pay a house off?
Can you say that again? You have
$10 million in the bank.
Okay.
You still have it in there after you bought a $3 million house. Something happened at the house because you got a loan on it. You put down half. Mm-hmm. And you decide just to go into foreclosure. Can let that go into foreclosure even though you have the money to pay it off?
Yes, because your home is a collateral loan. Your house is stable collateral. I used to work in consumer loans. I used to do auto loans before I did mortgage. Auto loans, boat loans, car loans. So I saw a lot of, you know, those are collateral loans, but they're not stable collateral loans because back in the day, you know, we had to collect on the cars. People would buy cars and you couldn't find them. I mean, it was, you know, they didn't have the technology they have today or the DMV connection, things such as that. So I went from that and credit card loans, you know, people would default on those. Things go wrong, go bad, they stop paying them. When I went into from that part of the industry into mortgage, and I was training with a mentor, and I was real hard, you know, on my analysis and evaluation. Oh, you know, they've got some lates, or they've got some this, or, and that was before DU or LP. So it was very judgmental. For underwriting was judgmental back then. And it was fair, but it was judgmental. It was a lot more leeway. You had compensating factors, things such as that. And I remember saying, oh, no, they've been late here and they've had this and blah, 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 blah. And my mentor explained to me that you don't have to worry about that with mortgage lending because your collateral is going nowhere. It's stable. They're not going to take the house and move. They're not going to take like they do cars. You know, you think I had that mentality, you know. Of default and taking the things with them. You know, you buy a washer dryer, you take it and you never find it. That a home is stable collateral. And believe me, the lenders, they don't like it. They're going to make their money off of a house. You know what I'm saying? They're going to get it back.
Okay, got it. Yeah, okay. That kind of explains it. Okay, yeah. All right. That makes sense. Okay, thanks.
I got a quick question on refis, if I could
interrupt for a moment.
On a non-owner occupied, is there a standard fee on refine when you're taking cash out?
You mean the cost or?
Yeah, the cost of the refi. Is there a standard?
Oh, okay. When you're doing refinances, the cost change depending on whether it's an investment, whether it's owner-occupied, whether it's a condo. The cost for a condo loan is more than it is for a residential. I mean, a single family. I'll say this, not the cost, the allowable LTV, loan to value. So if you're doing a cash out loan, I had one of those today. It's a cash out loan. He wanted to do cash out and subordinate. And with subordinate, it was going to bring it to 85% CLTV. Now, CLTV is combined loan to value, which means you have more than one mortgage on there. So every mortgage you have on your home is an entity of your loan to value. So he couldn't do 85% CLTV or LTV. I'm sorry, I'll just make it simple. He couldn't do 85% loan to value with cash out, and you can't. It's 80%, 80% or less loan to value if you want cash out. Now, if you're not doing cash out, you can do, I think you can do almost 90, you can do up to 90% no cash out, depending on the program.
The thing is, like this property was like, the loan on it is like $235,000. The property is valued about $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
Draw out about $25,000, and they wanted to charge me $10,000 to do the refi, saying they would roll the cost up into the refi.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question was, $10,000 a reasonable piece of refi?
Well, I don't know. That has to do with the points and the fees and the cost. You know, all that has to do with that, because the points, you know, of course, you can always buy down or buy up. You know, if you don't want to pay, you know, you can, if you don't want to pay 2 points, if you pay 2 points, then, you know, you can get a better rate, right? And if you pay less points, you pay another rate, things such as that. So you can buy it down or buy it up, that type of thing. So that all depends on that. That varies.
Okay.
Uh-huh, that varies.
So I think that's the last of the questions. Did you want to end with any information, Ms. Meeks?
I think we've just about covered anything here. Oh, PMI? Private mortgage insurance. Private mortgage insurance is when you borrow over 80%, when your loan is 80 over 80%, pardon me, if it's 80.1 or 81, you're going to pay mortgage insurance. That's also standard. There's no way around that. So unless it's portfolio. So if you, I'm trying to think of how to put it in layman's term. If you finance, you know, you put 20% down. Well, when you put the 10% down or 15% down, that's when you pay PMI. And PMI is private mortgage insurance. That is an insurance that insures the loan because of the risk. And it's standard. It's on anything that's over 80% financing. So
that's added to the mortgage?
You pay, right. Your mortgage payment, it has an additional fee.
Okay.
Some people, and that depends on the loan amount. It has a lot of things. It goes into the system, and their PMI companies that the lenders go through. There's like Guardian, Radian. There's several different ones, and they let there's a system you go in, and they let you know what it would cost. Oh, okay, this is a 85% LTV loan, blah blah blah, for this amount of money, yada yada yada, and it'll spit out and say, okay, then the PMI monthly is going to be $200 a month, you know, that type of thing. And that's what PMI is. It's now PMI is because of the risk, because it's over 80%. But if you can get PMI off, and you don't have to refi. Back in the day, you used to have to refi to get PMI off practically. Well, what you can do is, and there used to be seasoning. It had to be on 2 years or this or that. But now what you can do, I have a friend now, they bought a townhouse 3 years ago for $325,000. And the townhouse now is worth, the places in his complex have sold for $420,000. He's gained almost $100,000 equity. Well, he got his loan at 95. He got a 95% loan. It was over 90% or 95. It was something like that. So he had the PMI. And the PMI is like $300 a month, $325 a month extra to his mortgage. So I was telling him the other day, you can get that PMI off while you have the equity, because the PMI will come off. You can go to your lender, excuse me, and inform them you want to remove the PMI. And what they will do or should do is get appraisal comps. They're going to look at comps to make sure you have the value. And for what you, for instance, he bought that place for $325. So they're going to look to see if his, if what he paid for it, if he's within less than 80% or 78, 80%, which he is because he's got $100,000 equity. So they can look at it that way, and they will remove the PMI. You don't have to refinance. It'll just lower your mortgage payment.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that too, but that's real important to know. Because it helps you get in. You know, PMI helps you get in because you need the, you know, you're going to pay it anytime you're over 80%. Anytime. If you finance 81%, if you finance 80.02, you just pay a lower rate of PMI at depending on the cost is less depending on the exposure. Versus if you have a 95% loan, your cost is going to be higher than if you have an 85% loan, like that. Yeah.
So that's something for me to investigate, because.
Yeah. Well, you know, that one more question since you brought that up. Now, when you do the 20%, the PMI, now, do you still have an option of with the property taxes and your insurance when you pay, you know, when you put down 20%? Can you still say, hey, I want that taken out of my impound account? Yeah, does impound account disappear when you pay more than put down more than 20%?
No, you can impound. And your impound will include your PMI.
But if you put down 20% or more, you can say, I'll just do my own taxes and insurance.
Most lenders now are requiring that you impound. Now, there's still some that have options. A lot of them are requiring that you do. It's actually the best way to go. You don't have to worry about taxes, because if you don't pay your taxes for 5 years, your property goes to trustee sale.
Right.
They'll sell it right out from under. I got a lady I know is going through that. She married a guy. He's older. He had a house. He got a HECM, which is a reverse mortgage. And, you know, he had been in the house for years. You know, he has no mortgage payment. Well, what happened was she didn't understand, you know, she's a little disabled too and didn't understand what was going on. He's in the hospital and, you know, well, what's going on? They're telling me this. They thought someone was trying to steal his property out from under him. When I researched it up, he had a reverse mortgage. So with the reverse mortgage, it threw me because you don't lose your home with a reverse mortgage. You just stay in it till you die and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, it goes back to the bank or someone buys it. And what happened was he didn't pay his taxes, you know, because 5 years they're on property. So it had to be five years. He didn't pay the taxes and now they're losing the house. And matter of fact, he passed away the other day. So it's just, you know, one of those things. But yeah, your PMI is in with your impounds, and your PIT is your payment, interest, taxes, and insurance. That's your mortgage, principal, and interest, taxes, and insurance. And then of course the PMI is in. If you have it, it goes in with that. But that's your top ratio. That's called housing ratio. And that divided by your income is a top ratio. And then there's a bottom ratio, which is your PITI, which is your payment, full payment with all your other liabilities, car payment, credit cards, yada, yada. Because your mortgage payment might be $2,500. Taxes and insurance, PMI, just say it's $2,500. And your debts might be $500. So your top ratio is the $2,500 divided by your income. And the bottom ratio is the $3,000 divided by your income, because it includes the $500, your debts and your liabilities and your new mortgage.
Okay. Well, this is real good information. I really enjoy the explanations with the examples and you know, the acronyms, the finding of the acronyms. Yeah. Very good information. I appreciate all of this. It's excellent. Good.
Yeah, and because it's foreign to people. It becomes foreign to people. And anything you don't know and work with or whatever, it's foreign to you. It's like another language. So I try to help out as much as I can. And, you know, like I said, with real estate, you know, people think, oh, well, you know, I can't buy this or I can't buy that. Well, if you can't buy that, look where you can buy, you know, and things are going up. So people have been we're being priced out all over the place. You know, it's crazy. So just go where you can. I mean, Brianna was doing a transaction for a friend of hers. She has to have a triplex and, you know, they're hard to find. So she found one and it's in, you know, not so great of an area. Well, not a great area really at all. And I'm not bashing things, but it's a tough area because she wants to live there. And then it needed a lot of work, a lot of work. So, you know, it was just a whole lot of changes. It didn't go through because she was trying to qualify off the rents. That's another thing I didn't go over, but she wanted to qualify with the rental income. And she couldn't she needed more money down and she wanted to negotiate with the sellers and they wouldn't because what she wanted to do was qualify with the rents. Like if you own a duplex and you live in one of them and you live in one and just say you live in a duplex, just say your total mortgage for both places is $5,000, even though I know that, I'll just say $5,000. And you rent the duplex out and you stay in the front. Well, you can receive income from that duplex as a consideration, because if you rent that other one out for $2,500, or just say $2,000, I'm making the figures out of my head easier. The lender's going to take 75%. Well, first of all, if it's on the tax returns, they're going to use the tax returns. But if it's before you have applied it on your taxes, just say you've had it, you know, not a year, or it's not on the taxes, they're going to take 75% of the rents from that property. And you'll get 75%. Of the rent, they take off 25% for expenses. So if it's $1,000, which makes my calculations easier, you'd get like, they'll take $750. Now in this case, they don't have to subtract the mortgage. For instance, if you have if you have units or a rental, if it's a house, you're renting a house out. The lender, if it's not on the tax returns as of yet, now if you've had it and you haven't rented it, then that's enough. But if you haven't claimed it on your Schedule C as of yet, Schedule E, then you rent it for $2,000 and they're going to take 75% of that $2,000 and deduct the mortgage, the payment. So if it's $1,000, they take 75% of the $1,000, they give you $750. And if the mortgage is $350, they subtract that. So you'd get $400 cash flow. That would be your cash flow. That's the way that is looked at. But if it's on the tax return Schedule E, then we use the Schedule E. and determine it from there.
Okay. Well, this was a good presentation, and I'm going to encourage everybody to watch it. And I thank you very much for doing this, and hopefully we can get you back on here to give us more information.
Oh, sure. I'd love to help. I like to help my people so that they are aware of, what they can do. Because, like I said, there are programs out there, especially for first-time buyers. If you're a first-time buyer, there's a lot of grants out there, and you can use more than one grant. Some people think, oh, well, I got one grant. You can use more than one grant. Sometimes people have a problem because their income is too high for the medium area. But for the most part, you know, they've inflated that. They've increased that because of the cost of everything. So as long as your income is within the medium range, I mean, the teachers union, Silver Service, the city, different banks, the program Brianna went through, it was with Boston Private. They had, they were a portfolio lender. Portfolio means that they don't do DU or LP. It means it's actually the way lenders were before DU and LP, because DU and LP, you have to go according to their guidelines. Remember, I would say, well, this is the way Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. You're not going Fannie Freddie. It's the lender's choice, and it's the way it goes into their portfolio, and they keep the loan. They don't sell it to the secondary market. So the portfolio loans, they can adjust, because she even got PMI, and it was a 95% loan. That's unheard of, but that was the program that they had at that time that they allowed. But you're not going to get no PMI with a conventional Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan. You just won't see it, or FHA. You're not going to see it. So it was what they did, and that was a program they got people into, you know, got loans in, and it worked. But it was an excellent, excellent program.
Okay.
So there are things like that out there that people need to know. You got to look for it. You got to search. You know, there is NACA, of course. NACA is very time consuming, but it works for people that are, you know, first time buyers and trying to get things, you know, situated. There's a lot out. It's more out there than we realize.
Good to know. Okay. Professor Ra, who do we have for Monday?
John Musgrove.
Okay.
And he's an international entrepreneur, and he'll be talking about, you know, business in Africa and wherever else he's been. You know, he started out as a young person in entrepreneurship and pushing business. Yes.
Right. Excellent. Okay, next week for the CEN show, we have Sister Making It Happen coming back. She's coming back for the third time, and she's going to be talking about ending Women's History Month, celebrating the female principal in our lives. So that should be very interesting. And Ms. Meeks, we hear Mondays and Wednesdays. You could always join anytime you like.
Thank you.
It's open to the public. And thanks a lot for coming this evening, and we will be contact. We'll be in contact.
No problem. Great. I hope I hope I've helped.
Oh, you really did. Okay. So each one teach one, and Conscious Corner. Good evening. Mm-hmm.